This is the No Dogma Podcast. I'm Brian Hogan, and this evening I'm joined by Spencer Schneidenbach, software architect and Microsoft MVP based in St. Louis. Thank you very much for taking time out of your evening to join me, Spencer.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So to start off, Spencer, can you tell me a little bit about yourself, please?
So yeah, I am I'm a software architect for a startup in St. Louis, Missouri called Rivet. We make integration software for the construction industry, which is pretty exciting work in my opinion, moving data from A to B.
So is this business to business type work?
Yeah, so we're kind of an enterprise-y integration company. So we talk to all the software packages that other people don't want to talk to. So we connect those systems together, and it seems to be a healthy demand for it, which is always nice.
And then as a Microsoft MVP, do you have some specialty that you're categorized under?
Yes, Visual Studio and development technology, specifically in ASP.NET and general C# and web.
So tonight we're going to primarily talk about APIs, and I know that within your own role at work, you consume a lot of APIs.
Oh yeah.
So is that you are writing APIs for third parties to consume, or are you consuming third party APIs?
Largely consuming third party APIs. And so that's kind of where I wrote a blog post, and we're talking about this, and I've done several talks on REST APIs because I've seen ones that are done really well, and then I've seen ones that are done horribly. Occasionally we will build an API-ish thing for another company, but by and large we're consuming a lot of APIs most of the time.
And one of the things that I found when designing APIs or working with APIs, and as it happens, I have some friends who are API product managers, it's deciding what drives an API. So in your experience, who do you think is best placed to drive the design of it?
So the when you're designing an API, this is like stage zero, right? A lot of developers want to get to building. That's what we love to do, right? But when we get, what stage zero should really be all about, who's your consumer? Right? Who's going to be actually consuming the API? If you don't have that in mind from the get-go, your API construction is almost doomed from the beginning. And that's really a business-driven decision. It really is about, like, what is this API being designed to be used? Is it being designed so that customers can integrate get data and create data, so they can build their own custom integrations? Is it an API beyond that? Is it something that we're going to be using internally? Is it a API for a single page application, right? I mean, you'd think that a lot of people boil it down to, oh, it's just gets and posts with JSON, or JSON, or however it's pronounced. But there's more thoughtfulness behind it than just like the technical moving of the data back and forth.
So I made a podcast some years back. I looked back. It was 2015, episode 29. It was about the importance of developer experience. And again, that was largely around API design. But the guys I interviewed, a company called LucyBot, their perspective was the API design should, the consumer that we're referring to is primarily the developer. Do you view it the same way, or are you talking more about a different person?
No, I mean, the developer experience is absolutely a component of that. I talk about it as I usually say, like, how quickly, like, especially if you're a developer driven API, like Twilio is a great example. Twilio is one of my favorite examples of an amazingly built API for a lot of reasons. And one of the primary reasons that they're great is they allow developers to go from zero to make magic happen really quickly. You sign up for an account, you give them your phone number, they give you an API key, they give you code samples, and then you go and just start texting your phone. And the moment you do that, it's like you do it very quickly. It's going from zero to make magic happen very quickly. And then Twilio has you hooked, right? So developer experience if an API is a large part of your business, like Twilio, is huge. But it's, you know what, just stop it as huge.
No, I got you. But then when you talk about the business, let's say, if you were to say the business drives an API, but then who is the business? If the developers are the ones that are going to consume it, and developer experience is the important thing from one perspective, what's the perspective where the business is the important consumer?
Well, so I mean, integrations, I'll go from, I'll give you an example, right? So integrations for a company can add a lot of value, right? Like your ability to be able to talk to an accounting system, or for your customers to be able to get data out in a programmatic way, adds a lot of value. So when I talk about business value, I talk about who, not just about who's going to be using the API, but what it's going to be used for, right? Like if you surveyed all of your customers or potential customers, and they largely say that, well, we went with this other competitor's product because they have a really good integration API, then you as a company say, well, that's an opportunity that we're missing out on. So you then put money and resources behind building that API. But once you start building it, absolutely things like developer experience should be at the forefront of your mind.
Okay, got you. So we're going to kind of leave behind the business concerns for the rest of the conversation, mm-hmm. and we're going to turn to more the API design from a technical perspective. So one of the things you come across as a developer when you first start developing web API or whatever it happens to be is nouns, not verbs. Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
So just a little bit of history. APIs have kind of evolved quite a bit over the last several years. And a lot of APIs that are still being maintained that I still consume are SOAP APIs, which aren't they're not ideal for a lot of reasons. They aren't inherently bad, right? But one of the things that they kind of did was they were very RPC style, right? Where you'd say
RPC, what do you mean?
Remote procedure call, kind of like calling a method, right? But calling a method over the web. Okay. So when you would want to get a list of customers, say from your accounting system, if they exposed a SOAP API, the way that you might interact with that SOAP API might be called get all customers, right? But that has some problems, right? And it's largely around the question of consistency, which we'll get to in a little bit, and the importance thereof. But you can say get all customers in a lot of different ways, right? You could say get customers, get customer list, etc., right? And I've seen some SOAP APIs do that where they use different kind of verbs. A lot of REST API design, and we're talking specifically REST APIs right now, center around the idea of nouns, right? Where you just go, the API that you consume is accountingsoftware.com/API/customers, right? It's very noun centric. You don't have to worry about the verbs are all in the HTTP verbs, literally get or post if you want to create a customer, whatever. But it's very noun centric and it's very consistent. And the reason that that's important is because that's kind of when it comes to REST APIs, it's kind of where REST API design is going it's gone really. So staying consistent with the rest of the world will help your developers give them a better experience by being consistent with pretty much everybody else.
So you're saying to use the, for example, the API/customers with a get, and that can get you a single customer or it can get you multiple customers. And then what if you want to do a filter on those? Is that possible?
Yeah, absolutely. So I see it done a couple of different ways. A very simple search might be doing filtering just with a GET request in the query string, right? You say, I want all records where the last name equals Smith. And you could add that to the query string. This kind of goes a little bit off of like what GET versus POST is, right? But like most of the time when you are just getting data and not mutating, you should do a GET request. Some more complicated searches can use POST if you have a lot of search data in the body of your request. And I believe we were talking before the show about how you've used a search verb, which I've never used before.
Yeah, so along with the get, put, post, delete, patch verbs that you might commonly use, I've been using one called search. I think it's not quite an official standard yet, but Fiddler supports it. It allows you to have the typical header URL, but allows a body. So if you wanted to perform a search for multiple people, let's say you wanted to search for Brian in Boston, Spencer in St. Louis, someone else somewhere else, you can pass in an array or a list or whatever you want into the body to perform complicated searches. Doing anything else, like trying to put that into a query string, would be impossible.
But yes.
I don't see it in use a lot, which is a little bit of a surprise.
Well, I think that it goes back to what you just said about it's not probably widely adopted. And it kind of goes back to the consistency question, right? Like if I've never seen a search a search verb in the wild, and I don't think most people are aware of it. So most people just do post requests for complicated searches right now.
So if you were, though, let's say, let's talk a little bit about the HTTP verbs. So the common ones are get, put, post, and delete. Mm-hmm. So you were saying get is primarily used for getting information, and post is for creating, let's say, a new record. What about mm-hmm. put and delete? Sounds pretty easy, but there's put and patch. So can you explain those ones?
Yeah. So so I'm going to go with the kind of the typical use case, right? There's nothing in the, one of the things that's confusing to people about REST is that there's actually no prescriptive way to implement it. They're not saying this is the way to do it. So a lot of these people are just learning as they go. So that said, put requests are typically used to mutate objects, and they're typically used to mutate an object. So if you pass it in entirely, so if you pass in a JSON object where it has a first name, last name, and a phone number, right? If you're doing a put request, a lot of APIs ask that you just resend all of that data with each request. I see some people, not a lot, use patch in place of put. And I've also seen patch be used where you actually specify not only what data gets mutated, but how. And I don't know a lot about that. I usually kind of go in between. I say if my put, I don't expect my put consumers, if I'm building an API, to provide every ounce of data. If they just provide a first name that they want to mutate, usually I just mutate the first name in place and move on with the request. I don't see a patch out in the wild very often. It's mostly put is what I see for updating data.
So that's one, let's say, aspect of it. You have your verbs, get, put, post, delete, patch, as you see fit. But what I've seen sometimes with APIs out there, not necessarily ones that might, let's say, become popular projects on GitHub, but within companies I've worked for, where people will have a controller and they'll have a method called get customers, but it'll take a post. I assume you would frown upon the sort of the mixing of a method name with a get in it, but it's taking a HTTP verb called post.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it would probably be consuming or confusing for the, not only the consumer, but the developer, right? If you're doing a put or post request and all you're doing is getting data, most developers that are consuming APIs expect that a post would cause some kind of mutation. So you're already kind of going against the grain right there, which I would never recommend. I try to stay consistent, break the rules where you need to, but try to mostly stay consistent with what other people are doing, which, by the way, takes research and thoughtfulness. So on the other hand of that, the developer, if you've got a method called get customers and it accepts a post request, a developer coming in is going to think a little bit like a consumer and think, well, wait, why are we doing a post request just to get data? You know, so you try to maintain that consistency with what your consumers would expect, because ultimately you want them to be really, for want of a better term, delighted to use your API. You want to make the experience as easy and seamless as possible so they'll keep consuming it. Because some people build real products based on top of other people's APIs. Of course, it can add a lot of value for customers. So you want your developers to want to use it.
You used the words experience and expect there again. You've used them a few times throughout the earlier parts of the recording. But so as a developer, I expect an API to work a particular way. But that's me as a consumer. The person who's developing it might need to change something. So let's say there's an API to search for, I don't know, people. But I need now, as a developer creating that API, to add in some new property or remove some property or change something. How do I go about that?
So for most cases, if versioning is your best bet, it's once you have an API published, it's almost never a good idea to change some behavior of that API. Certainly removing properties is a terrible idea, and even adding properties can be bad. Some of the things that we do at Rivet include API design for other people. So we'll go into a company that really wants to integrate with the systems we integrate with, and they'll say, we need help building an API, or we need help expanding our API. And that's great. And we love doing that. And if we're working with you and you're changing your API while your API product hasn't been released yet, that's totally fine. But once you've put the blog post out there that says this API is available now, and this goes for anybody in general, changing that API should really be done with versioning. I had a really interesting story once where all of a sudden an integration broke, and we weren't sure why. And it turns out that they added a property to the API. And we actually, on that same API class, we deserialized it. And they added a property to that API that was matched a property on the class we were deserializing to. And it was going from a string to like an object or something like that, or some kind of concrete type. And it ended up that deserialization broke the integration. And we finally figured out that they added this property in the future. And they said, oh, we needed that. You know, we needed it for our own consumption. I was like, no, even adding a property can have really like unintended side effects like that. And certainly removing a property the same. So almost always versioning your API, it becomes the best way to make changes going forward.
So when you're talking about versioning, though, I've seen people discuss this. You can have, let's say, a whole API, multiple controllers with many different endpoints. Do you version the whole set of those? Or could you say, you know, the whole API is version 1, but this controller is version 1.1, but this method, let's say this endpoint within it, is version 1.2. What's your advice on versioning more broadly?
So APIs, like if you're exposing a certain set of APIs into your business, it's good to just from the consumer's perspective, right? You don't want to confuse them too much by having multiple methods that could have multiple versions, right? So it's best to, like, if you have a set of APIs that you want to expose to your system, it's best to version them all in one go, right? So that you could say that you could expose 10 APIs, some to your customers or vendors. I'm using accounting data because that's mostly what I work with as an example. AP invoices, AR invoices, right? You can expose all those as endpoints. And then you could say, well, these are all version 1 of all of those 10 endpoints. If you need to make changes to one of them, if you've got a lot of API consumers, you should go back to the drawing board and really think, like, well, we should really think about making a second version of this API. And it really just depends on how quickly you need to move, whether or not you want to just release, or if you want to just kind of maintain consistency, right? If you want to expose all of those other endpoints as every other endpoint, maybe they don't change, but you want to expose them as version 2, you could do that if you wanted to. Versioning usually should be done should. I see it done in chunks a lot, and I think that tends to not confuse developers as much, or consumers of the API, which is always a good thing.
Do you ever end up with a very complicated scenario where, let's say, you've got APIs calling multiple APIs, calling other APIs, and you need some sort of version management within your own application to know that API A should call version something of API B, but it should call version something else of API C, and do it dynamically?
I think that's really a consumer concern as to which API that they're consuming. There's an expense platform called Concur, and they have a huge swaths of APIs, and they have version 1, 2, 3, 4. They've certainly done their fair share of exposing plenty of APIs, which is great because we need all of that functionality. And usually we as the consumer know, well, in order to get this specific piece of data off of a user or off an expense per se, we have to use the version 2 of that API because the version 4 doesn't expose it for, you know, whatever reason that may be.
Dear.
Yeah, and which is totally okay, but you know, it's us as a consumer to keep track. It's our job as a consumer to keep track of that. Now, I will say that I do see some kind of unique versioning techniques. So Stripe has a really interesting one where they do all versioning happens in the URL, right? You go to API/V1/payments to post a payment to their system. But they also might release minor version updates to that same API. And you can consume that by passing in a header that says, well, I don't want just version one. I want version 1.1 because it has this very specific breaking change. That's about as most nuanced as I've seen API versioning be. Most of the times, most developers are good to stick with versioning in the URL, in my opinion.
What about documentation? What do you see the role of that with regard to APIs?
I think that the best way I can put it is an API, a good API lives and dies by documentation. So documentation gives you a lot of things, right? It gives your consumers the ability to go from zero to make magic happen, and also answer really specific questions about their use of the API. At some point you're going to have to think about security, right? You're going to have to think about security when you're creating an API. You can't just have anybody just post to those endpoints and mutate data for your customers. So you have to document how do I get an API key, or how do I have my consumers authenticate via OAuth in order for them to consume this API? It also is helpful just to know the idiosyncrasies that your API might have. So one of my big rules for API construction is always be consistent, right? Try to be as consistent as possible. If you return an error message one way wrapped in a JSON object, you should return an error message that way for every other endpoint that you have. So that way it's consistent. And that's what your developers would expect. But let's say, for example, that there's a special case where you just can't do that. You have to return data in some other different shape. Your documentation is going to be able to call that out. Your documentation, you could put a red flag that says, like, you know, warning, this API has this different behavior, right? This behavior that's different from the rest of the API. So documentation, really very critical. And it's probably the part that people don't spend enough time on. They usually, if they're using ASP.NET Core, they'll usually NuGet for Swashbuckler, so they expose Swagger. And then they deploy that and they say, oh, we're documented, because it goes through and it says, oh, based on this controller method, I should expect this data and then I should expect this output. And they think, oh, you know, everybody, let's crack open the bottle of champagne and go home because we're good, right? But really, documentation requires a lot of thought and nuance. And developers, we all know, terrible at documentation. I certainly share that. But it's really important for your consumers. Call out to give a general idea of how your API is used, and to call out the things that are different about your API that maybe they, or things that they wouldn't expect.
So when you're talking about documentation here, are you talking about the XML tags that you can put at the top of a method, which then Swashbuckle will generate into a friendly document? Or are you talking about something else?
So yes, the XML comments on the top of, specifically if we're talking to ASP.NET.
Let's say Core. We're going to talk about API, web API, because most of the audience, I think, is .NET.
Okay, right on. So yeah, perfect. So yeah, adding your XML comments and then having Swashbuckler, generate documentation for that. That's amazing. If you can maintain that very well, that's a great start. A lot of people don't even do that.
You're talking about triple slash.
The triple slash to add the XML comments to the top of the method that you're exposing as an API. And that's great. If you can keep everything within your XML comments, that's a hugely great like step to making sure that your consumers are happy. But Swashbuckler isn't going to generate for you a very guided step-by-step, like, here's how you authenticate to our API. Here's how you can get started quickly. Swashbuckler doesn't care, doesn't know about that. So you really need to craft documentation around, like, you need to make a priority around crafting documentation that will allow your consumers to get started really quickly and answer really important questions. I always go back to Twilio as my default, like, king of all APIs. And one of the things they do really well is they document literally like everything. So if you get an error code back from their API, let's say you send a text message and you get an error code 20,000, right? They provide you the error code. They provide you the link to the documentation, and the documentation is like really specific. It's like, here's why this error was thrown. And here's like the three or four common places where you'll be able to fix this error, right? And again, this requires a lot of thought. This requires a lot of thoughtfulness. But it's really important, especially if your API is external, if you're not just an internal API, it's really important to your consumer that you get documentation right.
Who should write the documentation? Are we down the road of technical writers, or is it, do you think, a developer task?
I think it can be a mix. It really depends on the company structure. If Rivet were to create an API, we don't have necessarily technical writers, so it would have to be a good amount of developers really contributing and saying, like, what would I want to see in order to get started on this API? Dog fooding, for example, is very important to us. And when we create internal APIs, we try to consume them as much as possible. And usually that kind of smokes out potential problems or, confusion points that developers have. It depends on company structure, really. Depends on who you have on your team. But it should start with the developers. It could be as simple as, create an API and then you put it in front of somebody else and say, put a simple document in front of somebody else and say, hey, get to using my API as quickly as possible. And then have them help you figure out where are all the problems? Where are the points that I got confused?
You've mentioned consistency a few times. Why is consistency so important with APIs?
I think it goes back to being kind of predictable, right? So it goes back to predictability so that you frustrate your consumers as little as possible. So I go back to the error message example, right? So you could be writing a JSON API where you return an error message that's wrapped in an object, or maybe it's an array of error messages. So you could say, I'm trying to create a customer on this API, but I didn't provide a first and last name. Well, I need to tell you as the consumer that first and last name are required. So you might want to return, a JSON object that wraps all of that information. But if you have another API that's right next to it, that's the same version, maybe it's creating a vendor in an accounting system, and you do a post request to create, and then it doesn't return a JSON object, it returns just a string that just has one error message in it. And you're kind of looking at that and going, well, like, why are these so radically different? Why do I have to think, why, there's a great book about user experience that's called Don't Make Me Think. I treat APIs the same way. Good API design is user experience for developers. That's what it boils down to. And I want the developers to be pleased, like happy enough to consume my API, to not get frustrated and yell at me on, support tickets or Slack or whatever.
It is interesting, though, because we are at the point where we as developers will often be the people who make the decision on what API we buy. Do we buy Stripe? Do we buy PayPal? Do we buy something else, the Bank of America one? And whatever we as developers say is best will be fine with the company, because from their perspective, costs roughly the same, within a couple of $1,000s a year for some companies, not a big deal. So we drive that.
Yes.
A lot of API builders don't necessarily realize that.
Yes, that is so huge. And that goes goes right back to developer experience. I can tell you that text messaging via an API is not a ludicrous concept. It's not, Twilio doesn't own that world simply because they may have been the first, and that's very powerful. I actually don't know if they were. But one of the things they've always done well is developer experience. Like, to send a text message via their API, you can do it so quickly. And it gives you that sense that it gives developers a sense of empowerment. And a developer doesn't want to focus on consuming an API to send a text message. They want to focus on, like, how can I make that text message meaningful to whoever's receiving it? And how do I make those connections quickly? And if you can get the API out of the way and just focus on getting stuff done, so much the better, right? The time that it takes for you to start using an API meaningfully absolutely plays into, you go to your boss and they say, oh, it costs the same. You did it in five. You send a text message in the first 5 minutes. Well, I'll just go with that one. And one of my former customers, they spend thousands a month on Twilio. And that's really powerful because that could have been a different company, but they chose Twilio because the developer really was responsible for the one responsible for choosing Twilio because it was so easy to use.
Any final notes before we wrap up for the evening, Spencer?
Yes, I help organize a conference in St. Louis called DevUp. We're a software engineering conference built by software engineers for software engineers. And we talk a lot about .NET and web. And it's a great event, very inexpensive to go to. So I encourage anybody who is looking for a developer event to attend or send developers to. St. Louis is a very great, cheap destination, and the content is out of this world. We have we're bringing in speakers from all around the country. We have workshops for Angular, React, and a lot of other content on .NET, including some of the people who build the stuff. So. It's a great event. You can find us at devupconf.org.
And dates?
October 8th through the 10th. So the 8th would be the workshop day, and 9th and 10th are regular 1-hour sessions. Come hang out with us. We throw a great party. Networking, super important to us. Come out and attend. We'd love to have you.
Well, Spencer Schneidenbach, thank you very much for your time this evening.
Yeah, thank you.
If you like this episode, you might also like episode 29, where I spoke with Lucy Bott about the importance of developer experience, or episode 51, where Rachel Reese talked to me about Jet, F-sharp, and microservices. The opening music was Return by Nisi 23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was East St. Louis Blues by Kathleen Martin with Damien Reba on piano.